I'll try in this half hour to give you a summary of our research at the Personality Disorders Institute. And for time considerations, of course, I'll go through some slides rather quickly, but you'll have a chance to look at them more in detail later on. We are an interdisciplinary team with psychoanalysts and neurocognitive scientists and psychotherapy researchers who have been working together. And I will limit myself to report here about the psychotherapy study and not the neurocognitive studies, not the fMRI studies, except one aspect that is relevant to the psychotherapy study immediately. These are our co-workers, and I would like to acknowledge the support we've had from these organizations, particularly the Borderline Personality Disorder Research Foundation, who has very generously supported our work over a number of years. And I would like to make use of this opportunity also to express my gratitude for being invited to this meeting and to the president of the organization, to Perry Hoffman particularly, and to the very kind words that were said to introduce me. We started out actually about 20 years ago, and our assumptions over the first few years was that the DSM Axis II makes it difficult to select homogeneous samples of patients with personality disorder, not saying anything new, and that it's clear that structured treatments are better than treatment as usual, TAU, and that with existing studies, it is difficult to see any superiority of cognitive, behavioral, or psychodynamic treatments of BPD, and that any superiority might emerge in the maintenance of gains. Now, this was our initial formulation. This has changed in the sense that we still believe today that structured treatments are better than TAU, and now we have evidence for it. And we don't think anymore of superiority of one approach over another, but we believe that different patients react differently to different treatments in the light of our clinical experience and presumably also of the research experience that we've had, meant the data of much of this still remained to be evaluated. So it's not a matter, it's really not a horse race. Our convictions have changed radically. But what treatment is best for whom, under what conditions? There are probably patients who respond to all treatments, some patients to none, and many patients who respond better to one or another. And I think that we are really only at the beginning of a long road. When we started out, we thought that the studies suggested that it was easier to change symptom than to measure or show change in personality. That's true to this day. And we quoted an old comment by Marsha Linehan, which I think fits very nicely in this. The main problem is how little data we have on the maintenance of gains. Clinically, we have experienced that patients go through psychodynamic treatments, one after another, don't respond, go to another for years. And the same is true also for DBT. There are patients who have been in various DBT treatments, and we have a kind of way of mechanically send the patient to the same treatment they've been in, unless because it's the road of least effort, and we are struggling with our research to change that. We developed a treatment, a psychodynamic treatment. In fact, this is the only manualized psychoanalytically or based or psychodynamic psychotherapy that exists at this point. And simultaneously, measures of the assumption that the personality of all severe personality disorders including the borderline personality disorder, but many others at that level, had a common organizational or structural frame that we called borderline personality organization and developed instruments to evaluate borderline personality organization with particular reference to certain aspects that seem crucial to us, identity, defensive operations, reality testings. And then we did, after developing the treatment and developing the instruments and of course using the usual instruments in research in this field, we carried out three trials. First, initial trial using patients as their own control. Second, a non-randomized comparison study between TFP and TAU, and then we felt secure enough in the efficacy of the treatment to carry out a randomized controlled trial. Now, let me describe briefly the treatment that we developed, and I'm doing this here only for purposes to relate this in turn to one aspect of our findings. It is a treatment that is structured by contract setting, requires two sessions per week. We have done it on outpatients, a duration of 1 year or more. And a major aspect of the treatment is this focus on the immediate interaction between patient and therapist. And the goal of the treatment is the resolution of what we call identity diffusion. And identity diffusion refers to a lack of integration of the concept of the self and lack of integration of the concept of significant others. We consider the paired representations of self and other as the building blocks of mental experience. And these paired representations are paired in terms of a dominant or peak affect state, so that the basic units of interaction, as well as the unit of structuring of the mental apparatus, in our view, are self-representations, object representations, and the affects linking them. So whenever one of these pops up, we assume the others are present. That's important because sometimes patients seem to have only pure affects, and in the clinical situation, we can link that to a real or fantasied or feared relationship between self and other. Identity diffusion is a syndrome that's diagnosable clinically and that consists in a faulty setup of this normal identity, this normal integrated self and integrated concept of significant others. What we have here is an unstable, polarized, distorted, and superficial experience of self and others, poorly modulated and unstable affective experiences with predominance of negative or aggressive affects, and a dominance of primitive defensive operation based on splitting, a subjective experience of inner emptiness, lack of authenticity, lack of temporal continuity, difficulty of accurately reading others. That's the syndrome that we are treating. Now, the treatment itself consists of strategies, tactics, and techniques. The strategies refer to the long-term objectives, the resolution of identity diffusion. These strategies are carried out in that we analyze the relation between patient and ourselves in terms of the activation of distorted primitive relationships that we gradually try to clarify, help the patient clarify the representations of self and object involved and the tendencies to alternatively project one or the other onto the therapist, and in this process gradually permit the integration of identity. More about this a little later. The tactics are interventions in every session, a number of rules. We intervene there where there's most affect, and there are specifically prescribed rules for what has to be taken up in what way, when. And the techniques correspond to habitual ways of addressing what happens from moment to moment, particularly the use of interpretation, transference analysis, and technical neutrality, concept that we take from standard psychoanalysis, technical aspects of standard psychoanalysis that we have modified for this treatment. Now I'm explaining the syndrome of identity fusion in the simplest way regarding the underlying theory. Here you have the basic unit, self and other united by an affect. We assume that initially experiences under intense positive or rewarding affects are built up separately and from experiences of intensive negative affective valence. And here you see these are intensively negative self and object representations, intensively positive ones, separated completely, at first neurobiologically and eventually by the psychic mechanism of splitting. There's now plenty of neurobiological evidence of separate paths and systems involved in positive and negative affect. I don't have time to go into this at this point. Normally, in the first few years of life, there's a gradual integration of the self, positive and negative self-representations, which tones down the respective affects. The same happens regarding the representations of others who become more sharply individualized from each other. This is normal identity with affect modulation, well-differentiated self and affect representation. So we try to remedy this process that has gotten stuck, and I'm not going to talk much about etiology, but we assume that the etiology is multiple and involves both genetic, constitutional elements involving neurotransmitter pathology and central nervous system structure pathology or hypoactivity, and problems in early attachment and severe dominance of a negative affect through by the interaction of temperamental disposition and environmental stimuli. In the treatment, what the therapist does is to structure the treatment to avoid destructive action while at the same time inviting the patient to express his feelings very freely in the sessions. And gradually we transform both affect storms, acting out, somatization, into cognitively clarified affective experiences. Clarification, confrontation, interpretation of these experiences helps the patient improve his sense of self and others. And we help the patient to tolerate previously intolerable identifications with very primitive representations of self and others that are ego-dystonic, gradually facilitating, as I said, the corresponding integration. The patient is expected to adhere to the contract, to have the freedom to live out affect and dominant object relations in the treatment, and as this happens, as the patient is able to express, let's say, his pathology fully in the relationship in the treatment, what we observe is that the relationship outside the treatment setting tend to improve, especially in relationships implying intimacy, love, sexuality on the one hand, and work, studies, commitment to ideals, friendship, social relations, values on the other. And at the same time, as a consequence of the integration of the concept of self and significant others, increase in his self-reflection about self and others. Back to our empirical work, first subject as their own controls, and then second study, TFP compared to TAU. After, I mentioned already that we had significant improvement in our first batch of 45 patients. And then the second batch, this one, we compared 26 patients who completed TFP with 17 subjects evaluated for the same treatment, but who didn't enter it, who didn't differ in terms of all the variables that we're studying, same inclusion and exclusion criteria. And we found throughout 1 year dramatic differences. Here you have the difference in visit to the emergency room. The TFP group reduced them significantly. The TAU group didn't. Then the same thing, days of hospitalization. Again, TFP improved significantly. And days of day hospital, same finding. The GAF score, I think this didn't come out well in your, didn't print out well in your booklet, but you see the increase of GAF score for the experimental group in contrast to the TAU. We then started the RCT study, and the design was BPD diagnosis. In other words, we restricted our patient population very strictly to DSM-3 criteria. Ages 18 to 55, randomized to 12 months of outpatient treatment, and we gave them three treatments, TFP, DBT, and supportive psychotherapy. Now, I don't have time to talk about supportive psychotherapy, which is a particular therapy also based on a psychoanalytic model, but that is different from psychoanalytic psychotherapy in that it does not use interpretation. It does not deal with unconscious meanings in the transference and represents the most concentrated effort that we have been able to manualize to provide direct support and encouragement on the one hand and facilitate the patient's identification with the therapist as a way to influence his identity and improve identity functioning. This would also help us to evaluate the specific intervention of interpretation characteristic of TFP. The patients were evaluated for medication, and we used the Solov algorithm to provide the medications, right predication for the patients whose symptoms justified by their intensity to be included in that treatment schema. I will not go into this right here, but we found out after 4 months of treatment that practically the patients did not need to use medication anymore. This goes for throughout the entire sample. And that the improvement had no relation to medication. So we felt, quite frankly, very relieved by that as one variable that had been troubling us all along. Patients were treated in private offices, although, of course, came through the system, and we planned a follow-up at a 20-month post-initiation as the first stage of follow-up. The initial study aim were to assess the efficacy of TFP compared with DBT and supportive psychotherapy and examine the mechanism of change in the treatment of borderline personality disorder. At that point, we already assumed that there are different mechanisms, different indication with different mechanism of change that may help these patients, and that none of this treatment would have monopoly for all interventions and mechanisms of change. And we wanted to link our findings with underlying neurocognitive, psychophysiological, and neural activities. I don't know whether you can read various publications that point to these aspects of the study aim. And we provided them with TFP. I've already described this to you. Dialectic behavior therapy, I think, is sufficiently well known by this audience, so I don't need to describe it any further. And I think for this purpose, what I've said about supportive psychotherapy is sufficient. The manual is based on the Lawrence Rocklin's manual of supportive psychotherapy for borderline patients, developed earlier in our own institute. The therapists were a mixture of senior and experienced, junior therapists, experienced in the respective treatment models, and chosen by the treatment cell leaders We had Barbara Stanley for the DBT, Anne Applebaum for supportive, Frank Jomans for the TFP, all three of them enthusiastic and convinced, experienced and knowledgeable in their respective treatments. And they had all practic cases and were rated, and patients were rated for adherence and competence. I think that there is nothing important here. At this point, the 90 patients have been evaluated, randomized, all treatments are completed, and the follow-up evaluation is in progress. The patients are a broad spectrum. We included men in this sample. You can see the details of, I won't go into this right now. High comorbidity, we excluded active major depression, major affective disorder, but not history of major affective disorder. We included active eating disorder that now required treatment for eating disorder, not history of it. Active alcohol drug dependency, but not abuse. A high level of comorbid personality disorder, about 60%, as in all other studies. And studied symptoms, symptomatic behavior, social functioning, personality change from beginning to end. And were interested in studying mechanisms of change. And the first one, of course, the specific mechanisms that we have postulated for TFP, the increase of consolidation of self and object representation. And we were helped extremely by the development of the measure of reflective functioning by Peter Funegi and his group. More of this a little later. At this moment, we are beginning our analyzing results. So I'm giving you the earliest that we have. It will take us about a year to complete the analysis of all 140 or 143 variables we have analyzed, about four or five so far. First of all, survival functions. We found out to our surprise that we had in the first 6 months about 20% dropout. But then after 6 months, there was a significant difference. DBT group had much higher dropout than the supportive and the TFP group. We can't interpret this at this point. It may be that DBT patients improved more quickly and that they obtained all the benefits that were to be had after 6 months. It may be that at that point, the negative aspects of interpersonal relationships began to affect the DBT group that does not analyze this aspect of interaction, but we don't know. This has to be studied. Then we found, here is a summary of predictors studied so far. I mentioned already the DBT dropout, and then poor reality testing is associated with dropout in supportive treatment against our expectations. Usually it's said that patients with very poor reality testing should be in supportive treatment. Second, the poor quality of object relations was associated with dropout in all three treatment cells. Schizotypal dimensional scores was associated with dropout independent of treatment cell. And there was no difference between treatment cells on any of these patients' variables at baseline. Now, we used, this is just to illustrate the method coming from Lenzenweger, hierarchical linear modeling. 5 minutes? Okay. And this has particular statistical properties that I'm going to jump over. And the preliminary results are suicidality. Significant improvement in TFP and DBT, not in supportive psychotherapy. A very important difference. I think Barbara Stanley found the same thing in her recent research. Depression, significant improvement in all three groups. Social relations, significant improvement in all three groups. GAF score, significant improvement in all three groups. Now, here is the description of the adult attachment interview, a special interview that studies the patient's description of past relation with significant others, and that is used to derive from there their capacity for reflective function, which is the social, cognitive, and affective process of interpreting and making sense of behavior in oneself in others in terms of intentional mental states. And it includes the capacity to reflect on one's own experience. It has a number of aspects that I cannot go into right now. And we also analyzed the coherence of the description of these mental states of representation of self and others derived from the adult attachment interview. And different degrees of coherence indicate the degree of level and potential improvement of general cognitive function in contrast to the specific capacity for increased self-reflectiveness. Here is the reflective function scale developed by Fonigy and his group, going from negative to exceptional. And our findings were that regarding coherence, all three treatments improved cognitive coherence as measured by this instrument. But only the TFP group improved reflective function in contrast to the DBT and SBT group, so that the specific mechanism hypothesized for TFP seemed to us confirmed, and this is now the basis of our hypothesis to evaluate to what extent this increase is related to long-term change or not, to be evaluated. In summary, then, coherence and reflective functions are strongly correlated at the beginning of treatment, but not at the end. Low reflective function correlated with, and we also found, I don't have time to talk about this, but there are on the initial study of neurocognitive measures, we found that low reflective function is correlated with poor maintenance of set, in other words, capacity to maintain a set for correct response when stimulus change, and impulsivity as measured by neurocognitive tests. The implication being that increase in reflective function has a direct correlation in neurocognitive and probably prefrontal cortex and cingulum functions that needs to be explored separately. And it's very interesting that coherence increases in all three, but reflective function only in TFP. 1 minute. The questions are still open. What are the fundamental mechanisms of change in the other treatments? How do they relate to long-term maintenance of change? Then I was going to present a clinical case, but you can read it up later on. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Kernberg, for a very elegant presentation. Let's see if we have some questions. I think, you know, what Dr. Kernberg is introducing is, you're going to hear about four different protocols for treatment this afternoon and four different studies. And one of the things Dr. Kernberg has touched on and introduced is that we know that all of these treatment protocols have efficacy in treating people with borderline personality disorder. But one of the bigger questions is what's going to help them to maintain those goals, and also being able to decipher which treatments are right for which patients, because probably different patients need different things, and also to look at whether patients need different things at different phases of their development. So I think those are all important issues that we might consider this afternoon. Let's see, we got some questions here. This question, Dr. Kernberg, is what are the if we would comment on the possible neurobiological mechanisms by which reflection upon affect makes intolerable affects tolerable? How does reflection transform an intolerable affect into a more tolerable one?
Yeah. The basic mechanisms is that the intolerable affects have to do with intense, unmodulated negative affects linked to terrible imagined, real, or feared experiences with significant others that repeat themselves in the transference. The patient experiences his most terrible problems in the relation with significant others in the transference. But at the same time, at other times, he experiences idealized, perfect moments of being understood. And gradually, the fluctuation between extremely positive and extremely negative relations with the therapist begin to influence each other, modulate each other. The patient realizes the therapist is not all good, not all bad, and the same is true for the patient. And the unrealistic nature of those deep convictions about terrible experiences modifies those intolerable affects. And so the increase of reflective function related to the integration of concept of self and significant others at the same time implies a modulation of the affect that influence each other mutually.
Okay. Here's a shorter one, but could you please explain transference and transference-focused therapy as if you were explaining it to a child?
Please, children in the audience, come forward. I want to talk with you separately. For the moment, let me explain it to adults, okay? Mm-hmm. I'll deal with the children later.
Okay.
To the adults, I would say that what is called transference in psychodynamic and psycholytic treatment is the unconscious repetition in the here and now unconscious pathogenic experiences of the past. The most important pathogenic experiences from the past are structured into the patient's character structure, into his habitual behavior patterns. They are activated in the relation with the therapist. The therapist does not react like the original persons with whom the patient had those conflicts would have reacted then or now, and is what is called technically neutral. And in this process, it permits the therapist to gradually examine with the patient what's the reaction about, what are the patient's fears, view of the therapist, and transform that fantasied situation into the real one. That is what we call transference reduction. For this, it is very important that the therapist help the patient to express fully all his fears, ideas, feelings, positive or negative, with certain limits. We don't let the patient attack the therapist physically or destroy the office or assault the therapist sexually. So, and all these are things that happen with the very severely ill patients, some of whose past traumatizations are reactivated in the treatment situation. And their gradual analysis and resolution in terms of the strategy that I mentioned then permits the working through of these terrible experiences. So that's what's transference and transference-focused therapy.
I think that helps, doesn't it? Okay. I have several requests here for the clinical illustration. The illustration that you left out at the end that they would like.
I'll be glad to, but I don't know it by heart. I would have to.
Oh, you'd have to go back. Okay, well, maybe we should do something different.
What do you want me to do? Shall I go back to that or not?
Probably not.
Yeah, okay.
We have about 5 minutes.
I think 5 minutes.
Okay.
This is a patient treated by another therapist from the TFP group. It was a 37-year-old unemployed woman who had gone through many unsuccessful treatment. In the last 6 months, she was isolated in her apartment, gaining weight, disheveled, not bathing, very poor interpersonal relations, rationalized because of her ethnic background. She had never, 37 years old, had sexual relations except one attempt by a boyfriend, leading to formal rape charges on her part and occasional self-cutting. She had had three brief hospitalizations, diagnosed as bipolar disorder that was not confirmed in our very careful initial evaluation. And she came from a middle daughter, highly educated family, and a very prestigious, dominant but caring father. She had dropped out from college, a number of job losses because of interpersonal difficulty. She ended up fighting with everybody and was thrown out wherever she was. She hadn't been working the last few years. In the treatment, she started out in a very domineering, controlling, dismissing attitude toward the therapist. And the therapist made as a condition for the treatment that she should go back to working in order to explore her difficulties at work, giving her a period of several months to do that. And she fought with him nail and teeth and finally went back to work. And in the transference, he interpreted consistently the relationship between a hostile, grandiose, arrogant object or other and a victim threatened with abandonment, and how she perceived him as this persecutory, hostile object, but without being aware, was also treating him this way in her hostile, arrogant, dismissing way. And gradually, all this, of course, is not an angry, critical remark, but a kind of a very careful, gradual exploration of what's going on in the sessions, which she could generalize in her understanding to what, and which the therapist helped her generalize what was going on in the job, when, again, she was at risk of fighting with everybody. And gradually, this came to be clearly related to the relationship with a very dominant, loving but dominant and aggressive father. And in that connection, the development of positive feelings with the therapist, sexual feelings toward the therapist, that and great fears about the terrible nature of having sexual feelings to a father figure that could be gradually resolved and led to, again, relations with men, a relationship, first a bad relationship with a very dominant man, and then a good relationship with a stable boyfriend, including good sexual relations, improvement in her work situation, and in her interpersonal relations. Over all of this, over 1 year of course, and this was one patient where reflective function increased enormously. She started out with the low doses of Neurontin, which was tapered off during the year, in fact, from the very beginning, because the therapist thought it was completely useless, but gave the patient time because the patient, again, thought it was an insult or an attack to reduce the medication. That's a nutshell.
Terrific. Thank you. Okay. One more question? This one has to do with contracts.
Yeah.
Okay. How much time is generally required to have the patient agree to a contract? And then also, what do you do when patients don't keep their contracts?
Yeah. When we talk about contract, it's not a written contract, but it's really an understanding reached in several sessions. It may take 2 sessions, 5 sessions, 10 sessions. We don't have any case where it took more than 15 sessions, but we have a case where it took 15 sessions. And okay. The contract is set up explaining to the patient very clearly the rationale, why it seems indispensable. For example, if the patient is extremely, let's say, one of our cases, who was stabbing herself with a knife into her vagina and having severe infections. So the contract was every time she stabbed herself, she had to see her gynecologist, who would then treat her and let us know whether she could continue to be seen on an outpatient basis. The patient thought that this was outrageous, that she should have to see, expose herself to the gynecologist, and took about 10 sessions. But you see, so the contracts are eminently reasonable. Mm-hmm. In terms of survival of the patient, we're trying to protect the life, the physical health of the patient, and of course, when the therapist is a risk also of the therapist. Mm-hmm. Regarding what if the patient breaks the contract? If the patient breaks the contract, the patient is told that if the patient breaks the contract on principle, the treatment will not be able to continue until we refer to another therapist. But once the patient breaks the contract, he always gets a second chance. The therapist saying, I'm willing to see you again, but you see how strongly the temptation is to end this treatment. And from that point on, the interpretation of the danger to the treatment because of a second rupture becomes part of transference interpretation. It's like a continuous ringing alarm signal that colors the interpretation until the danger of a repetition of this is eliminated. I also should say that it's part of the technique that as soon as a contract is set up, there is an immediate interpretation of its implications for the transference. Just to set up a contract and leave it at that is totally useless and counterproductive. So the combination of contract setting and interpreting the transference implications is what helps. And then when after a first break, the consistent analysis of the danger. And if the patient breaks it for the second time, then the treatment is ended and the patient is referred to another therapist. I mean, this is part of the responsibility. We have had great success with this approach to deal with severe chronological suicidal behavior. I'm talking about suicide based on the personality structure, not depression. Mm-hmm. And all kind of strange symptoms, and also on the patients who had gun collections and were shooting at their neighbors. So we have had difficult cases.
Right. We have one much more general question, which is, could you comment on what you see as the differences between TFT and mentalization-based therapy and DBT? What are kind of the fundamental theoretical differences? Yeah,
well, you're talking about difference between three treatments. Yeah. Dr. Fonigus, mentalization therapy. I think you should ask the mentalization part to Dr. Fonigus. DBT. Both DBT and TFP are both highly structured treatments. They are specific treatment for this condition based upon specific theories about the underlying psychopathology, theories and assumptions, some of which are evidence, some of which are theories that still need to be explored. The difference is that DBT provides what I would call direct support, encouragement, and learning by skill training. I think the validation is in terms of raising the patient's self-esteem through acceptance is probably a background to both treatments. We don't call it validation. We assume that capacity for empathy with the patient is fundamental for treating these patients. If I had time, I would talk about what empathy means, because it's not as simple as it seems. It means empathy not only with the patient's central subjective experience, but with the patient, with aspects of the patient that he cannot tolerate in himself or herself, and that the therapist has to be empathic with to help the patient, to help the patient tolerate that which he can't tolerate. So it's complicated, but I don't see that as a major difference. The skill training is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And so that I would say much more direct structuring and encouragement. And the analysis of the relationship, our systematic analysis of the relationship is something that is not done in DBT, as far as I know. Regarding our difference with mentalization treatment, I have invited Dr. Fonigus to come and talk more about this, because I think that there are differences, but we have not yet fully clarified them. I think probably Dr. Fonigus will tell you that he's concerned about early interpretation and that he thinks it's risky, that it has to be gradual. And we believe that it is helpful to interpret from the very beginning, and that needs to be explored further.
Fine. We have one more brief question. Your policy on telephone contact, given that that's different than what's offered in DBT, has that changed, or is there still no telephone contact?
No, it hasn't changed. I would say patients are encouraged to call whenever there is some serious crisis and they need help. The therapist has a responsibility. I'm available to my patients 24 hours, and so is every therapist. But if the calls are
for something that is not a crisis, is not appropriate, then the therapist discusses it with the patient, and the patient calls again for the same issue, then it may be structured. And the therapist say, I'm available, but this is not a crisis. Whenever you have that problem, that has to wait for the next session. I will not take your phone call. And so then there the structure builds in.
Right. I think with that, we now have to stop. Thank you,
okay.
Dr. Kernberg.
Thank you. Okay.